This is Tom on February 11th, reading Bloomberg Business Week February and Bloomberg.com on February 11th. Fed's path to more rate cuts challenged by job surprise. Unexpectedly strong employment data for January reduces the chances the Federal Reserve will see a need to cut interest rates again by mid-year, as the most concerning possibilities for the trajectory of the labor market seem more remote. Worries about rising unemployment that prompted 3 rate cuts at the end of 2025 before a pause in January were likely eased by numbers out Wednesday showing 130,000 jobs were added last month and unemployment fell to 4.3%. Fed officials at last month's policy meeting had already cited signs of stabilization as a reason to hold rates steady. Wednesday's report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics prompted traders to pair the probability of a rate cut at the June meeting, previously eyed as the most likely timing of the next reduction, to under 50%. It absolutely complicates the argument for lower rates, says Tim Mahady, a former senior advisor at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. The January data were really strong. Economists cautioned that the upbeat January numbers could yet be revised lower and that hiring continues to be dominated by a handful of sectors, primarily healthcare. Revisions to last year's data showed job gains averaged just 15,000 a month, down from the initially reported 49,000 pace. Yet the bounce in January will calm fears that unemployment was set to keep climbing amid worries over the impact of artificial intelligence and widespread concerns that companies were putting hiring plans on hold, said Stephen Stanley, chief U.S. economist at Santander U.S. Capital Markets, LLC. The health of the January numbers certainly should put a nail in the coffin of the idea that the labor market is on the cusp of falling apart, which is what we were hearing a lot from some of the doves of the Fed, Stanley said. Kansas City Fed President Jeff Schmid, speaking Wednesday, said the central bank needs to keep rates at restrictive levels to continue putting downward pressure on inflation, and added he's not seeing many indications of restraint in the economic data. President Donald Trump continued calling for more rate cuts. In a social media post after the jobs data were released, Trump hailed great job numbers and said the U.S. should be paying the lowest interest rates globally. Trump's National Economic Council director, Kevin Hassett, told the Fox Business Network there is plenty of room for the Fed to cut rates, citing a big supply shock from AI that will boost growth without creating inflation. Kevin Warsh, whom Trump has said he will nominate to take over as Fed chair after Jerome Powell's term ends in May, has echoed those views. What Bloomberg Economics says, the January payrolls report lessens the urgency for the Fed to cut rates. But as we expect inflation to ease in the coming months, in particular, we expect a more subdued reading on January CPI due February 13 than the consensus forecast, we think policymakers have room to cut rates and to support the labor market recovery. In all, we expect the Fed to cut rates by 100 basis points this year. Fed watchers caution that it's too soon to make calls on where the economy will be by June, when Warsh would chair his first policy meeting if he is confirmed by then. For now, key indicators are suggesting a firming labor market and broader economy, none of which immediately lend themselves to Warsh's calls for lower rates, says Stephanie Roth, chief economist at Wolfe Research. It makes his job a bit harder, she said. CBO boosts U.S. deficit call by $1.4 trillion on Trump's policies. The Congressional Budget Office on Wednesday warned yet again that the U.S. is on an unsustainable fiscal path, jacking up its estimate of deficits for the coming decade by $1.4 trillion, thanks in part to President Donald Trump's 2025 tax law and immigration policies. Trump's signature fiscal package from last July, which extended his 2017 tax cuts and implemented a number of new breaks, is estimated to increase deficits by $4.7 trillion over the next 10 years, the Congressional Budget Office said in a report. The cost of all the administration's immigration enforcement actions are expected to add $500 billion, it also said. Those losses are projected to outweigh Trump's dramatic import duties, which have taken the average effective tariff rate above 13%, according to an estimate from Bloomberg Economics, the highest since at least the 1940s. The CBO projects the increased revenue from tariffs will reduce deficits by $3 trillion. Net outlays on interest are also expected to drive deficits higher, surging from $1 trillion in 2026 to $2.1 trillion in 2036 due to the large amount of debt and higher average interest rates. Should the CBO's forecast pan out, it would rebuff the hopes of Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who has continued to target getting the deficit down toward 3% by the end of Donald Trump's term. For 2026, the CBO boosted its deficit projection to 5.8% from the 5.5% it had projected prior to Trump taking office. For 2028, the predicted gap is 6%. And by 2036, the government will be running a deficit equivalent to 6.7% of gross domestic product. That's well above the 3.8% average over the past 50 years, the CBO said. Total deficits are projected to equal or exceed 5.6% in every year from 2026 to 2036, setting a record as deficits have not been that large for more than five consecutive years since at least 1930, when the data was first reported, the CBO report shows. The report also shows that the agency doesn't see the administration's receipt of tax reductions, tariff hikes, and deregulation as sufficient to generate a steeper trajectory for economic growth. The CBO expects U.S. economic growth to be stronger in 2026 at 2.2% compared with the 1.8% it had projected in January last year. It then sees a moderation to 1.8% in 2027 and 28, and remaining at that rate on average through 2036. That's well short of the 3% growth rate Bessent is targeting. With growth rate higher for this year, the CBO extended out its forecast for when the debt ratio hits a record high. Last year, the agency forecast the U.S. hitting a 107% debt-to-GDP ratio by 2029, exceeding the 106% record set in 1946, just after the end of World War II. Now the agency doesn't expect the ratio to hit a new high until a year later in 2030. Much of the rise in the debt is thanks to elements outside of regular annual federal appropriations for discretionary spending categories such as defense, housing, or homeland security. Interest on the debt has surged in recent years, while outlays for the giant entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, have also climbed. As high as it is, the current level of debt shouldn't pose a problem, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell said last month. The challenge, however, is that the government is on an unsustainable path. We're running a very large deficit at essentially full employment, and so the fiscal picture needs to be addressed, and it's not really being addressed, Powell said in a press briefing. As for inflation, the CBO does not see it getting back to the Fed's 2% target in time, averaging that pace over the half decade to 2026. But it's seen remaining stubbornly high at 2.7% for this year, ticking down to 2.3% in 2027. Unemployment is expected to rise to 4.6% on average in 2026. The release was prepared in December, prior to Wednesday's latest job report. Trump privately weighs quitting USMCA trade pact he signed. President Donald Trump is privately musing about exiting the North American trade pact, people familiar with the matter said, injecting further uncertainty about the deal's future into pivotal renegotiations involving the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. The president has asked aides why he shouldn't withdraw from the agreement, which he signed during his first term, though he has stopped short of flatly signaling that he will do so, according to the people who spoke on condition of anonymity to describe internal discussions. A White House official asked about the discussions described Trump as the ultimate decision maker and someone always seeking a better deal for the American people. Discussion about potential action amounted to baseless speculation before an announcement from the president, the official said. An official in U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer's office said that a rubber stamp of the 2019 terms was not in the national interest, and the administration intended to keep Trump's options open and negotiate to address issues that had been identified. Both officials spoke on the condition of anonymity and declined to directly address whether Trump was musing about an exit from the trade pact. Greer said Tuesday that the administration would hold separate talks with Mexico and Canada, arguing that trade ties with Canada are more strained. He did not say whether Trump would approve an extension. Generally speaking, these negotiations are going to proceed bilaterally and separately. The Mexicans are being quite pragmatic right now. We've had a lot of discussions with them. With the Canadians, it's more challenging, Greer said on Fox Business. The Canadian dollar and Mexican peso both weakened on the report, wiping out gains from earlier in the session. The U.S. dollar also paired an early loss before strengthening more forcefully after a stronger-than-expected employment report. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum on Wednesday downplayed the likelihood that Trump would withdraw the U.S. from the deal. "We don't believe it, and it has never been said in the calls because it is very important to them," Sheinbaum said during her daily press conference when asked about the Bloomberg News story. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney said Tuesday he had a positive conversation with Trump that included talk about the USMCA review, though he didn't elaborate on those discussions. The Office of Canada's Minister of U.S. Trade, Dominic LeBlanc, declined to comment on the matter. The U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement is set for a mandatory review before a possible extension on July 1, a process that was once expected to be routine but has transformed into a contentious negotiation. Trump has demanded additional trade concessions from Ottawa and Mexico City and pressured them to address unrelated issues, including migration, drug trafficking, and defense. Greer will recommend renewal if a resolution incorporating input from industry stakeholders can be achieved, the official said, noting stronger rules of origin for key industrial goods, enhanced collaboration on critical minerals, worker protections, and dumping, all as areas of possible concern. If the countries agree to a renewal, the accord would remain in force for another 16 years. But if that doesn't happen, it could trigger annual reviews for a decade until the deal's expiration in 2036. Any country could announce their intent to withdraw with 6 months' notice. Such a move would shake the foundations of one of the largest trading relationships in the world, The pact covers roughly $2 trillion in goods and services, and even the threat of a U.S. departure would stoke uncertainty for investors and world leaders. U.S. business groups and lawmakers would almost certainly rebel. The prospect of higher tariffs would also threaten to exacerbate affordability concerns heading into November's midterm elections, in which Trump's Republicans already face an uphill battle to keep control of Congress. Trump routinely polls key aides on issues. The questions can be insights into what is on his mind, but are far from certain in predicting his actions. It's unclear if Trump will threaten publicly to leave or formally give the warning. It's possible if he did so, he may use it as leverage to reach a more favorable deal rather than follow through on pulling the U.S. out of the agreement. Trump has already started to ratchet up pressure on Canada and Mexico. He's threatened to hike tariffs on Canadian goods to 100% if the country's brokers a trade deal with China. Raises levies on aircraft from Canada to 50% if it does not approve certain Gulfstream jets. Refused to allow the opening of a new bridge linking Ontario and Michigan, and vowed duties on products from Mexico and others that ship oil to Cuba. USMCA replaced the North American Free Trade Agreement, which controlled trade between three countries since 1994, but became a target of Trump's ire during his first run for the White House. Trump threatened to leave NAFTA before agreeing to the New Deal that tightened rules, raised U.S. auto content requirements, and included a sunset clause, which mandated this summer's renegotiation. Even though he negotiated the current system, Trump has soured on the North American trading relationship. During a visit to a Ford Motor Company plant near Detroit, he called the pact irrelevant, but stopped short of saying he would quit it. He has also floated the possibility of negotiating bilateral agreements with Canada and Mexico. I don't even think about USMCA, he said. I want to see Canada and Mexico do well, but the problem is we don't need their product. Trump sent a different signal about the agreement last May when meeting with Carney, saying it's there, it's good. We used it for certain things and calling it great for all countries. But he noted then with the 2026 renegotiation was looming to adjust it or terminate it. Any U.S. exit from the USMCA might cause immediate economic pain by exposing more Mexican and Canadian exports to higher American duties. Certainly most goods, with notable exceptions including automobiles, traded under the agreement are exempt from Trump's global tariffs. As a result, Mexico and Canada have comparatively low average effective tariff rates compared to the other products from major economic powers. Both countries are the U.S.'s two largest trading partners and the top buyers of American goods, according to 2024 trade data. If exiting the pact triggers Canadian and Mexican retaliation, it could hamper his campaign pledge to boost U.S. exports. In the long run, the mere possibility of exiting the deal could push the three neighbors further apart and reverse a three-decade effort to integrate their supply chains. Carney at last month's World Economic Forum in Davos urged mid-sized countries to build new ties to resist economic coercion by aggressive superpowers, declaring the old rules-based international order a fiction. The landmark speech, a thinly veiled shot at the U.S., angered Trump and helped prompt his latest string of threats against Canada. The president's declaration in January that North Atlantic Treaty Organization troops stayed a little off the front lines in Afghanistan also rankled Canadians, many of whom have boycotted American products and scrapped trips to the U.S. over Trump's trade brinkmanship. Some 158 troops from Canada died in that conflict. Trump's unpredictability has kept world leaders off balance for the better part of his second term. His argument that the U.S. doesn't need to import automobiles from Canada has served as a warning shot to an industry that is closely integrated across all three countries, as well as his moves to tariff North American steel and aluminum. Yet he has also displayed a willingness to preserve much of the USMCA, particularly with the exemption from his tariff regime, which grew out of warnings from the auto sector. From Bloomberg Businessweek, the Imperial Presidency, the CEO's Handbook for Trump World. Tried and true strategies for surviving and even thriving in the new order. Corporate America is entering the second year of Donald Trump's second term with a new hard-won understanding. The president's personal interventions can shape business as profoundly as any economic force. From public attacks on media conglomerates to the ever-present threat of new tariffs, Trump has blown past the norms that have traditionally governed relations between the Oval Office and titans of industry. He strong-armed chip makers for a cut of sales, told Coca-Cola Company to reformulate its soda, and secured the government a golden share of a combined steelmaking behemoth. A single social media post can ignite a boardroom crisis. Just ask the executives at Cracker Barrel Old Country Store, Inc., which reversed a logo redesign after Trump fanned the flames of an online backlash. The president can tilt the fate of an entire industry, recently suggesting he should be involved in the takeover fight for entertainment giant Warner Brothers Discovery, Inc. All of this has created an environment in which companies have to recalibrate strategy to signal political fealty, or they risk a hit to their share price or reputation. Trump's whims carry the weight of market forces, reshaping capital flows, supply chains, and the very balance of power between business and government. For chief executive officers, that means adopting strategies for dealing with the most interventionist president in almost a century. Trump has brought an unprecedented personalization of government and business dealings, says Jonathan Levy, a historian at Sciences Po in Paris, who focuses on capitalism and the U.S. economy. His authority is rooted in his persona. He rules by making others dependent and subservient to him. Presidents have long pressured business leaders to back their agendas, though few have done so as ruthlessly as Trump. Franklin D. Roosevelt pushed through the New Deal amid fierce opposition from Henry Ford and other industrialists of the era. Bill Clinton's Department of Justice hounded Microsoft Corp and its CEO, Bill Gates, setting a precedent for later actions against monopolistic behavior. President Joe Biden had a markedly cool relationship with top business leaders. Some chafed at his antitrust push, climate regulations, and overt support for organized labor. Instead of consulting corporate titans, Biden often sought economic perspective from labor leaders or voters in his home state of Delaware. Against that backdrop, Trump's return to power landed in a business community receptive to a different style of engagement. That shift was visible at his inauguration, where Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, Sundar Pichai, and other billionaires had prominent seats, a scene few would have predicted after much of the corporate world turned its back on Trump following the January 6 insurrection. Taylor Butowich, who served as deputy chief of staff at the White House before departing in September, says Trump's focus is on advancing the American economy, and CEOs should be receptive to that. They may not see eye to eye on every issue, but he sincerely wants their companies and their workers to benefit greatly, Butowich says. That means the door is always open, and CEOs have ignored the BS narratives and sat in front of him to make their case, and it has moved the needle. Heading into 2026, Trump is confronting falling approval ratings, lingering inflation, and critical midterm elections. But given his propensity for ignoring conventional political forces, he's not backing off from leveraging his power to sway business policy in his favor. In the first 10 days of the year alone, Trump gathered energy CEOs at the Oval Office to encourage investment in Venezuela, declared institutional investors will no longer be able to buy homes to rent, and demanded that large defense contractors halt dividends and stock buybacks until they ramp up production. Hardly any CEO is willing to speak publicly about the effect of Trump's meddling, and traditional corporate advocates, including the Business Roundtable and Chamber of Commerce, declined to comment on the record for this story. Interviews with more than a dozen executives, lobbyists, public relations experts, and people close to the White House, several of whom requested anonymity to speak freely, show some of the steps companies are taking, such as building back channels and at least giving the appearance of acquiescence. Here's what we learned. Call it the CEO's guide to managing Trump. Find a way in. Known to hand out his number to executives, Trump is the rare president who can be reached directly on his mobile phone. During his first term, the president said Apple Inc.'s Tim Cook was a great executive because he calls me and others don't. In October, Trump said he canceled plans to send federal troops to San Francisco after receiving calls from friends in the area, name-checking Jensen Huang of NVIDIA Corp. and Mark Benioff of Salesforce, Inc. Love him or hate him, he's accessible. If you've got issues, he'll talk about it. United Airlines Holdings, Inc. CEO Scott Kirby said in a September interview, that doesn't mean he'll agree with you, but you can get him to engage in a way that politicians historically didn't engage. Still, access to Trump is tighter than it was during his freewheeling first term, and CEOs without a direct line can be reluctant to reach out, worried that any conversation could take an unexpected turn, says one person familiar with the workings of the White House. Less risky is finding a line into White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles or Cabinet Secretaries such as Treasury's Scott Bessent and Commerce's Howard Lutnick, both financial industry veterans. Top MAGA lobbyists like Brian Ballard and Jeff Miller also enjoy close access to powerful Trump officials and the president himself, thanks in part to their prolific fundraising. Even if a CEO can't land a one-on-one meeting with the president, that's not necessarily the worst thing, says David Urban, a managing director at lobbying firm BGR Group and an advisor to Trump's presidential campaigns. Any interaction with a high-placed member of the White House, even if it's just coffee at Butterworth's Cafe, a Washington MAGA-friendly hangout, is better than none. Business leaders are often reaching out to President Trump because they know they have a pro-business ally in the White House, says White House spokesman Kush Desai. But while President Trump is always willing to hear out the business community, the only factor guiding his decision-making is the best interest of the American people. Quietly maneuver. Playing to Trump's whims can take many forms, discreet or overt. The president no longer leans on the New York real estate and banking community as heavily as he did during his first term, according to people with his interactions. Now he speaks more often to tech CEOs and libertarian-minded figures such as Peter Thiel. He's kindled a close relationship with NVIDIA Swang, who scored an invite to the banquet King Charles III hosted for Trump's visit to the UK in September, as did Cook and other American CEOs. Speaking on Joe Rogan's podcast in December, Wang praised Trump as an incredibly good listener who says what's on his mind. Every single time I called, I needed something. I wanted to get something off my chest. They're always available, he said of the administration. That relationship paid off days later when the White House announced it would allow exports of one of NVIDIA's most advanced processors to China. Direct personal engagement can be a key for those with access. As Netflix Inc. was preparing its $72 billion offer for Warner Brothers, ex-CEO Ted Sarandos met with Trump at the White House and discussed topics including the auction of the film and TV company, Bloomberg News reported in December. Just hours before Paramount Skydance Corp. launched a hostile competing bid, CEO David Ellison was seen chatting with the president at the Kennedy Center Honors in Washington. For formal meetings, coming in with a gift can't hurt. Seeking relief from tariffs on foreign-made semiconductors, Apple's Cook gave Trump a glass plate with the company logo set atop a 24-karat gold base. And when a delegation of Swiss business executives visited the Oval Office in November to press for tariff relief, they presented the president with a gold Rolex clock and an engraved gold bar. Trump is predominantly driven by one thing, which is personal gain, says Jacob Funk Kierkegaard, a senior fellow at the Bruegel think tank. The guy is a medieval prince. He needs to be buttered up. Educate. Don't bellyache. Finding a seat at Trump's table is just the first step. What a CEO says next matters more. Trump values companies that can demonstrate deep ties to the Main Street economy, says Kevin Madden, a strategist on Mitt Romney's presidential campaigns, who's now a senior partner at corporate advisor Penta Group. That means emphasizing job creation and investment in the U.S. The best approach, leaders and their advisors say, is to understand what Trump wants on a particular issue, then explain how a company or industry can help deliver it. The president famously doesn't read briefing books, yet prides himself on his business instincts, so executives must explain complex issues simply. Making that argument with visual aids often helps, says Trump allies and advisors. Complaining or arguing rarely does. Do not stick your hand in the blender, cautions Urban. If you go in and make your case without being combative, you will definitely get a fair hearing from the president and his staff. Another option is simply keeping quiet. Walmart Inc.'s Doug McMillon didn't publicly respond when Trump commanded the company to eat the tariffs in a Truth Social post after the world's largest retailer said the rising cost of imports might force it to raise prices. Trump didn't single out Walmart again. The medium matters. Trump entered his second term with a well-developed ecosystem of conservative influencers willing to amplify his policies. In April, the White House launched WH Wire, a link-heavy aggregation site resembling the Drudge Report that cheers Trump's moves. A coordinated social media machine on around Elon Musk's X, formerly Twitter. Coca-Cola's interactions with Trump this past year exemplify the new landscape. In July, when Trump posted on Truth Social that Coke had agreed to use real cane sugar in the U.S., this appeared to come as a surprise to both Coke and its suppliers of high fructose corn syrup, the sweetener used in its namesake product. Coke responded with a short statement saying it appreciated President Trump's enthusiasm for its brand and promising more details. CEO James Quincy ultimately turned Trump's meddling into a marketing opportunity. When the company decided to unveil a new variant made with cane sugar in the U.S., Quincy promoted the change in a television interview with Liz Claman of Fox Business, a favored news network of the administration. Similarly, Eli Lilly and Company CEO Dave Ricks chose Maria Bartiromo's show on Fox as the venue to announce plans that the company would be making its new weight loss pill in the U.S. We want to work with the administration and others who want to make America healthy again and get these medicines to more patients, Ricks said. Everything's a transaction. Perhaps above all, the author of The Art of the Deal sees every interaction as a transaction. Urban of BGR cites a Beltway adage. The first rule of horse trading is to have a horse. In Trump's Washington, these transactions often hinge on what a company can offer or surrender to stay in the administration's good graces. That dynamic was on full display with Intel Corp, whose CEO, Lip-Bu Tan, sought something essential, a lifeline. What he gave up was extraordinary. Intel had been a major beneficiary of the Biden-era Chips and Science Act, a $52 billion effort to revive semiconductor manufacturing in the U.S. Trump dismissed the program as a waste of taxpayer money and a horrible thing. Within a span of days in August, the president called for Tan's resignation over the executive's past ties to China, then reversed course after the two met in private. The result was a deal in which the government acquired $8.9 billion worth of common stock, making it a top shareholder. The intervention cut against principles of American free market capitalism that investors and policymakers have long considered sacrosanct. But the White House framed it as business as usual, casting the Intel arrangement as a possible template for deals with other companies. Many businesses have also sought to stay in the Trump White House's good graces through donations or public pledges to invest in the U.S., even when those investments aren't new. Sponsoring the nation's 250th anniversary celebration this year has emerged as one relatively low-risk path, says Tevi Troy, a presidential historian who served in the George W. Bush administration. Companies like doing that because they're less likely to alienate employees or shareholders. Business seeking Trump's favor might also help foot the bill for his White House ballroom. The companies donating to the $400 million and growing price tag for the project, including Altria Group, Amazon.com, Caterpillar, Comcast, Google, and HP, among others. The Republican lobbyist Ballard, members of his firm, and a handful of its clients were spotted at a dinner Trump held to thank the donors in October. A trio of companies have opted to cover all their bases. Crypto exchange Coinbase Global, defense contractor Lockheed Martin, and data analysis company Palantir Technologies are sponsoring the banquet hall and the nation's birthday. Absent from either list is Wall Street titan J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, whose CEO Jamie Dimon told CNN he was quite conscious of the risk of doing anything that looks like buying favors. Dimon is the rare chief executive who wields enough clout that he can largely speak his mind regarding Trump. Most of corporate America doesn't have that luxury. For all the new strategies and carefully managed relationships, executives may find the coming year the hardest yet to navigate. We are entering an unprecedented moment with Trump, in that his political viability is more threatened today than ever before, says Phil Singer, a corporate communications consultant and former advisor to Chuck Schumer, Hillary Clinton, and other Democratic leaders. A playbook only works when there are clear rules for the game, but Trump can change them at any time. A CEO would be advised to map out their strategy in pencil, not pen, and keep an eraser handy. A unified theory of Trump. There's a through line that runs from tariffs to toppling a foreign leader. It's all about expanding the power of the presidency. With Donald Trump's barrage of executive orders and daily challenges to the judicial system feeding a nonstop White House news cycle, few people step back and wonder whether there's a philosophy guiding the president and his closest advisors. The bombastic pronouncements and sometimes entertaining missteps from senior officials and the president himself make it easy to assume there isn't one. Yet there is a theory of Trump of sorts. Most of the administration's actions, the questionable crypto dealings, the appointment of unqualified allies to high-level positions, the unconstitutional deportations and National Guard deployments, the ouster of a Latin American head of state, have a logic. They're all attempts to expand executive power, steps towards a type of imperial presidency. What constrains the power of any political actor, including the president, is how effective they can be in mobilizing resources, including personnel, to achieve their objectives. Additionally, the laws that prevent transgressions and overreach, along with the general norms that apply to the conduct of any particular office, will also act as brakes. Trump is attempting to transform the norms around the U.S. presidency. It would have been viewed as completely unacceptable for Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, or Barack Obama to ask his attorney general or the Department of Justice to go after enemies. It also would have been considered beyond the pale for a president to invoke a poorly documented crime emergency as a pretext for sending the National Guard into U.S. cities, or for a president to continue to be involved in his family businesses while in office. These norms have now been broken, maybe for good, but certainly for the duration of Trump's presidency. Behavior that looks like questionable judgment takes on a new cast when viewed through the lens of this norm-breaking strategy. Why would the Trump administration defy the order of U.S. District Judge James Boasberg not to deport alleged Venezuelan gang members to El Salvador? Was it a blatant mistake? After all, the same objectives could have been achieved in some other ways, less controversial and less visible way. Perhaps not. If you want to break norms, you have to challenge them, and this is just one high-profile way of doing so. Removing legal barriers to presidential power is an equally important part of Trump's project. This is where the Supreme Court comes in. Led by Chief Justice John Roberts, the court's conservative majority has shown a proclivity for expanding executive power in myriad ways. In a July 1, 2024 decision that came only months before Trump's re-election, the court granted American presidents near absolute immunity from prosecution on official actions taken while in office. In addition, the High Court has recently limited the ability of lower federal courts to issue nationwide injunctions that prevent presidential orders from taking effect. And it upholds the president's authority to fire heads of independent federal agencies without consent from Congress. The Trump administration has also been encroaching on responsibilities typically reserved for the legislation. In addition to withholding already appropriated funds, the White House has infringed on Congress authority by cutting lawmakers out of decision-making on national security questions, including troop deployments, tariffs, and oversight of conflict of interest. These barriers have been significant breaks in the executive reach of past presidents. Now they're being peeled away with fateful consequences, such as the Trump's family making as much as $1 billion from crypto deals that would have been investigated or prosecuted in prior administrations. Perhaps the most fundamental moves have been aimed at increasing the president's de facto power, meaning his ability to control and mobilize agencies and people in the administration. Although the Founding Fathers envisioned three separate but equal branches of government, a fourth branch emerged as an important participant in the wake of the New Deal. Independent and semi-independent agencies, sometimes referred to as the administrative state, or by the MAGA faithful as the deep state. Dozens of government bodies, including the Federal Reserve, the Environmental Protection Agency, the FBI, the Office of Bureau of Management and Budget, and the Federal Trade Commission, are critical for the daily functioning of the government. Most of these agencies' activities aren't under the direct control of the president, and their members often have a commitment to the mission of the agency, as vividly illustrated by the conflicts between the current administration and the Federal Reserve. By appointing loyalists to head many of these bodies, Trump is expanding his de facto power. They will be more likely to obey his whims and much less likely to challenge him, even if he's acting unlawfully. Seen this way, Trump's predilection for appointing agency leaders who lack the proper credentials or necessary experience for the job makes a lot of sense. The more unqualified they are, the more loyal to Trump they may be, and the more inclined to collaborate in destruction of norms. Even Trump's foreign policy should be viewed through this lens, not just as confirmation that he's always been obsessed with tariffs and transactional relations between sovereign powers. Allowing a president to unilaterally set tariffs and restrictions on different goods from different countries, as Congress has effectively done, translates into a huge increase in his domestic power, because greater sway over global affairs always translates into greater visibility and authority at home. But even more fundamentally, Trump's ability to single-handedly upend the supply chains of major American companies, whether Apple Inc. or Walmart Inc., makes these businesses subservient to him. As such, I believe Trump's tariffs and even the forceful removal of Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, are much more about his domestic agenda than about foreign policy. What makes this domestic power grab agenda dangerous is that it's the meeting point of two distinct impulses. The first, coming from Trump himself and his closest advisors, is about maximizing the power of this president so he can achieve his various objectives, whether they might be the enrichment of his family, the rolling back of progressive reforms, or the decimation of the bastions of his opposition, including liberal universities and law firms. The second impulse is rooted in a political philosophy that was mostly articulated by Carl Schmitt, a right-wing German jurist, writer and theorist who rose to prominence during the Weimar Republic and the Third Reich. Schmitt had great contempt for liberal democracy and parliamentary rule, judging them as either inappropriate institutions for the complex world of international rivalry and domestic turbulence, or simply facades between which powerful leaders still exercised unencumbered power. Schmitt called for a much more authoritarian conception of power in which sovereigns were supreme, and there was always a need for an ultimate decider in states of exception or moments of crisis, or even during regular times. Many conservative thinkers since then have dipped into Schmitt's ideas, especially during times when right-wing leaders found themselves stymied by legislative gridlock or other constraints of democratic decision-making. Schmitt's ideas are sometimes viewed as fringe, but they've always been close to practice. Both leftists and rightists, when in power, have wished to expand executive power. Both sides have often tended towards a certitude about what's good for society and the conceit that the executive could embody it, at least when it's from their side. It's this tendency that makes Trump's agenda so dangerous. Not only will the expansion of executive powers create havoc in the next 3 years and continue to enrich him and his family, but it will also change U.S. politics fundamentally, whether it's a Democrat or Republican who succeeds him. That's the real danger that follows from the theory of Trump. Kevin Warsh's Fed job already looks impossible. The latest Bureau of Labor Statistics report showed that the unemployment rate slipped to 4.3% in January from a prior 4.4% as U.S. payrolls expanded at twice the rate that economists have been expecting. While it's great news for workers, it will make life a lot more challenging for Kevin Warsh, President Donald Trump's pick to become the next chair of the Federal Reserve. Trump wants his nominee to slash interest rates, but Warsh's Fed colleagues are likely to balk if the labor market continues to hold up this well, creating the conditions for a volatile first year on the job starting in May. Although outgoing chair Jerome Powell has faced similar pressure, Warsh will be seen in the markets as an unproven and less predictable newbie at the powerful central bank. With Wednesday's data in hand, the unemployment rate, the most important all-in labor market statistic, looks to be settling in around current levels. It's now been in the vicinity of 4.3%, plus or minus 0.1% percentage point, for most of the past year. A key exception was the short-lived jump in November, which now looks like a fleeting distortion created by the government shutdown that ended that month. Prior to Wednesday, concerns about the labor market offered a clearest path to easier monetary policy, and an ebbing in those risks should foreclose on the possibility of additional cuts in 2026. The core personal consumption expenditures deflator, a preferred inflation guide among members of the Fed's rate-setting committee, probably ended 2025 at around 3%, a full percentage point above the central bank's 2% target, where it's been more or less since early 2024, and the Federal Reserve Bank's of Atlanta's GDP Now tracker suggests the economy may have expanded at a very strong 3.7% annualized pace in the fourth quarter. In other words, there's a case to be made that monetary policy has achieved a sort of neutral setting. On the surface, at least, interest rates aren't doing much to push unemployment higher, nor are they bringing inflation demonstrably lower. A few policyholders have already acknowledged in their economic projections that the neutral setting for policy could be right around the current levels of 3.5% to 3.75%. And although they're still in the minority, with other policymakers offering guesstimates closer to 3%, the confluence of data suggests that the higher neutral rate crowd may have a point worth entertaining. Certainly, the inflation problem probably isn't quite as bad as meets the eye. Among other things, the Trump's administration's tariff policies are probably adding around half a percentage point to the reported inflation. And economic orthodoxy would suggest that Fed policy look through those one-off price level shifts. Economists will reevaluate that widely held belief next Friday, when the BLS releases the January Consumer Price Index. Some observers are bracing for high numbers, as firms may have used the start of the year to push through another round of tariff-related price increases. What's more, the labor market isn't without its blemishes. Of the 172,000 jobs added to the private non-farm payrolls in January, 124,000 came from health care and social assistance, non-cyclical corners of the labor market that aren't exactly the hallmarks of an economic boom. In most sectors, it's basically the case that companies are neither hiring nor firing very much, meaning that existing orders feel more or less fine, though new labor market entrants are facing a hard outlook from, and job losers are remaining unemployed for longer. And with tariffs weighing on profit margins and artificial intelligence starting to threaten some business models, labor market watchers will have to keep a close eye on layoff announcements to see if payrolls take an unexpected turn for the worse. For now, I mainly take Wednesday's positive report at face value. Payrolls saw their strongest growth in more than a year, in spite of a large drop in federal jobs. The number of people working part-time for economic reasons, i.e. those who wanted to work full-time but might have had hours reduced by managers, declined sharply after a couple of disconcerting reports. Labor market resilience is never a bad thing for the American people. But Trump has been banging the drum for rate cuts since the start of his presidency. No sooner had he announced Warsh's nomination than he was cracking jokes about suing him if he doesn't cut rates. On Wednesday, he celebrated the positive jobs number in a post on Truth Social, and yet confusingly seemed to imply that they provided justification for lower rates, which is either ignorant or willfully deceptive. Needless to say, the Fed's job is not to help facilitate the federal government's deficit spending. Such a mandate would be a one-way street to an enduring inflation problem. For his part, Warsh understands this and may well steer policy based on his reading of the economic reality. Still, he'll have to contend with relentless pressure from the president who is putting him in the job. Assuming he is confirmed, Warsh is going to have to use the data in hand to make a coherent monetary policy case to the 11 other voters on the Fed's rate-setting committee. And with the current constellation of facts, he'll have a hard time convincing them that the economy has an urgent need for many more rate cuts, or possibly any at all. Five questions. Rolls-Royce Motor Car CEO Chris Bromwich talks tariffs, EVs, and catering to the world's ultra-rich. The average age of your customers has come down to the low 40s. How are you appealing to these buyers? What we saw about 10 years ago is our younger clients were asking for more subversive interpretation of what a Rolls-Royce was. That might have been more vibrant colors or darker metal finishes on the exterior. It attracted a very different group of clients and drove a reduction in the average age. At the same time, the age at which ultra-high net worth individuals are accruing wealth is lowering. How have you navigated the tariff cost in the U.S.? When the tariff situation was announced, we responded by working with our dealer partners to ensure there was no uncertainty for them and for our clients. And while we haven't just slapped a tariff onto our pricing, we always look at our pricing every year because there's a lot of different factors at play in terms of material costs, inflation, etc. One of the wonderful things about Rolls-Royce is that we're present in every part of the world, so we're not and haven't been and won't be dependent on any one particular part of the world. The largest region is the U.S. However, every other region is pretty substantial for us, and the trend in terms of performance has been pretty consistent this year. How have you reacted to any slowdown in electric vehicle uptake? We only build a Rolls-Royce if someone asks us to make it. In the production facility here, along the same line, we can produce V12 early electric powertrain Rolls-Royces. So we can adapt depending on the demand. We don't set out to say, right, we'll make X number of those motor cars. We only build what are ordered from our clients. How do you keep up with new technology? Our clients expect a Rolls-Royce to have all of the relevant technology, but they do not want their Rolls-Royce to feel like something which is overwhelmed with technology. So little things like the temperature control. It's a manual chromium switch, and it's simple and easy to use. How closely do you work with parent company BMW on strategy? We're blessed because this business is run independently. Our shareholder is the BMW Group, and our job is to make sure that we deliver a meaningful return to the group. We have the benefit of the access to technology, but the freedom to act and execute it in the most brand-appropriate way. I can't think of a better setup for Rolls-Royce.